You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, I'm Mike Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. We're here this week with Marion Wiggins, whose novel John Donger has recently been issued in paperback. It's my intention here really to speak to her about her writing, so I thought I would get the inevitable political and news items out of the way quickly. What brings you here?
Well, the paperback publication of John Donger. I'm a year and several months late, but I'm going exactly everywhere that I was intended to go for the hardcover publication of John Donger, from which I was detained. And I must say, I love the open. I just heard that snatch of song for the first time in my life, and we're also the only we are the only animals who blush. So watch out, Michael.
No, it's an odd thing because it made me think when I heard it. It was a childhood song of Charles Olson.
I missed it, and we seem to be of the same age. Somehow I escaped that experience.
It was a little yellow record, and it made me think of Charles Olson's It Is a Human Universe, which seemed to me to be very moving. But then again, in the light of John Donger, a savage novel, it seems to be a good line, too. You are a human animal. What brought you to the materials of John Donger?
I think that there's a great fascination for any novelist or storyteller in the desert island idea, as our planet is more and more becoming an island in the universe. I feel that this old mythic idea of writing the desert island book is not just antiquated, it's probably the most modern idea. And so there was that idea of putting a group of people on an island, all of whom are prepubescent, of the female sex, with one adult man, to not only explore, again, the desert island idea, but also to have them up against elements of survival with received ideas that decay. It's an exploration in religion and social order.
The book is set in 1917 and is located on an island off the coast of Burma. And as I was reading, it seemed odd for an American writer to be writing a Death of the Empire novel. The girls are all British.
Why? We've got our empire, the empire of the dollar.
Of course.
Hence John Donger.
And so it seemed to me to be odd to be giving us stiff upper lip British parents and children when we have so many more examples that don't have literary precedence. I noticed that again and again people talked about Lord of the Flies, and I don't think they would have had the book been given an American cast.
Well,
of
I came into it was a technical problem more than anything else. I am an American writer. The novel that I'm working on now is set in Washington, D.C., Richmond, Philadelphia. It's about the people who wrote the Bill of Rights. It's set in 1789. I'm clearly an American writer. I'm identified as an American writer through this text in all the 11 translations into which John Donger has been translated. But the problem that I ran into was that I wanted to write a desert island book, and technical problems first. That meant setting it somewhere where there couldn't be airplane reconnaissance and radio transmission. That sort of more or less set the time. So that sent me back beginning of the 20th century, end of the 19th century. And at first I had thought that I might put the book on the frontier. But America was colonized its west differently than its east was colonized, so that John Donger is not my finite statement on empire. I see the next three books that I'll be writing as, you know, sort of a trilogy about those colonizing influences in the history of the United States. And in order to approach that, you have to approach the British, because we have taken so many of their attitudes. It's against the British, it's against the English that we first made our revolution. So I think that this was my way of working through, because I'm only mid-career, working through my ideas. It was not, John Dollar is not the American book that I intend to write.
It's full of, you know, what to me were thrilling ventriloquial effects of the British voice run into hysteria. And another of the structural elements of the book that I liked very much is its composition in columns. Made me think of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
There's that. There's all those, the wonderful texts where there were margin notes.
Mm-hmm.
And also, this is an 18th century, 17th century device. The margins are quite wide into which notes are dropped. Part of this, again, is technique of the writing. John Dollar is a lot of things as a novel. It's an adventure story. It's a love story. It's a story of loss of innocence. But it's also, if you take it down to its bare elements, borders on melodrama. There's an earthquake. There's a tidal wave. These people are, you know, marooned on a desert island. One, the main character, the female center of the book, conveniently gets shipped off to the other side of the island and suffers an artificial, well, she suffers a temporary blindness for most of the book. This is straight out of Sidney Sheldon. This is melodramatic stuff. And then just when I needed her to regain her sight, coincidentally she does. I needed to pare the story down and write it in extraordinarily poetic and beautiful prose to carry off all that melodrama. And one of the ways that helped me to do that was to drop in these margin notes, so that if I had more detail to add on the periphery, I just drop them into the margin. A device that I've never used before and I won't use again.
Oh, that's too bad, because I kept
wishing. Oh, you liked it.
I'd wish there'd been more. The other day when I was preparing to do this interview, I'd reread The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And there, in that salt-encrusted shipwreck, those margin notes become chilling. A saner mind clearly is writing them, and yet the effect is every bit as devastated as the more dramatic text that is the body of the poem. It was a thrilling technique.
So there is this historical antecedent, but I didn't want to lean on it too heavily. So it's mostly up front. And toward the end of John Dollar, certainly for the whole second half, there ain't none.
Mm. The most of the beautiful uses of language for me were the echoes throughout, since these are young girls stranded on the island, the echoes in the prose throughout of children's rhymes.
Yes, I read a lot of children's rhymes. One of the things that I did in researching this book was I went back and read all of Grimm.
Mm-hmm.
And actually in the table of contents, I set up a little key for myself to discover which taboos were touched upon in all of those fairy tales. And it's amazing how many stories of cannibalism exist. I mean, just right off the top of my head, there's Little Red Riding Hood, with grandmother being eaten by the wolf and the hunter eviscerating grandmother out, and there she is. She's reborn after having been consumed by the wolf. Hansel and Gretel, where the witch bakes the little children into gingerbread people. Greed, incest, they're all in Grimm. I reread Grimm, and I reread Bettelheim, The Uses of Enchantment, and his recent death has, you know, touched me very deeply. But I did go back into the uses of enchantment, and I hope that some of that shows in John Dollar.
Well, I wondered, actually, because my feeling about the Bettelheim essay, and it's remarkable, an analyst, Bettelheim, was, I found myself thinking that his use of fairy tales, unlike yours, anesthetized fairy tales. He finds
he
the horror element.
He was using them toward a different end.
Mm-hmm.
He was using them to heal the psyche. And I didn't, as a novelist, mm-hmm. had a different end than
right.
he.
Right, this doesn't seem like a healing book.
Oh, why not?
Well, among other things, a book that begins with a large and populist cast that ends up with two, one
survivors.
Dead. Yeah, one being carried. It's a very grim book in both senses.
Yes, which is why what I said before, I hope that the beauty and the prose and the poetry of it does carry a sense of the author's optimism, because I'm not a nihilist. Nevertheless, I do want to bring the attention of the reader to all the elements of annihilation that is in our, you know, human animalism. We are human animals. Well, I would hope that at the end of it, perhaps there is some note of optimism and beauty struck.
I'd read somewhere that you'd spent some time with Paul Bowles out of an interest in novelists who'd been exiled or who'd made themselves exiles.
He's very much a voluntary exile. I mean, the fact that he has no passport and hasn't renewed it is Paul's, you know, choice. But I have followed on not only Paul Bowles. I mean, I reread constantly Gertrude Stein, living in London, because my rhythms are changing, and all you have to do is pick up one of her books, and there it is, the punctuation of the language without graphic punctuation is right there, and brings back the American rhythms to me, and she was an American living in exile as well. But also, Bowles was an accomplished musician, and I think I'm a musical writer. I think that I keep falling back on the rhythms in John Dollar and its poetry, and I think it's all there. And that's why I love reading Bowles, and also because there is this sense of doom and this impending evil that's around his work.
And a great deal of irony as well.
Yeah.
In that the writing is plainly civilized. That's the.
And there's all this stuff boiling up underneath it, yeah.
Oh, yeah. In fact, it seemed to me that for the most part, with the exception of Flannery O'Connor, the writers of what we might just for the moment call the ironized grotesque, John Hawkes, Paul Bowles, tend to be male. Did you have any feeling in bringing that kind of ferocity to what is in many ways a feminist narrative?
The feminist narrative you're referring to being
John Dollar by Marion Wiggins.
You think it's a feminist narrative? I've taken a lot of flack from feminists. In fact, the only bad reviews have been from feminists with the particular agenda, which was, why did I set this book on an island with a sole sex cast of characters, they being female? Why couldn't they have come up with a more perfect world than Golding's cast of characters, which were all male? So I've taken the only heat I've gotten in terms of critical review have been from the feminists. So thank you very much, because I think I am a feminist.
As a careful reader of texts, yeah. It seemed to me that the book was about, and you're dissimulating. The cast of characters in the book is not all women. At least a third of the book has their parents, and most of the language that the girls inherit is the language, a patriarchal language of stiff upper lip and religious
patriarchal attitudes, received ideas, absolutely
spiritual bits of effluvia that will not help under any circumstances. And
right.
So it seemed to me that what the book was demonstrating was that people who live with inherited values
absolutely
cannot survive by those values.
It's not written along sexual lines. The point of the matter is these might have been a group of little boys who also had these received ideas. But I did want to put a male adult at the center of the book, John Dollar, about whom we know very little. In fact, there is a bit in the book where the parents of the children are wondering who this captain of the ship is. Where has he come from? What does he look like? We don't know. The reader doesn't know. I don't know. I never describe his face in the way that the face of God has never been described, can't be described, because it can't be seen. Faceless government. So I did want to set an adult male as the archetypal patriarchal attitude at the center of the book. Consequently, it just became, again, technical considerations in constructing a good read. It became more interesting for me as a woman to make those children around him female as opposed to male.
It's also thrilling to see them in their gradually accelerating madness wandering around, in one case speaking Brazilian.
It's Portuguese, actually.
Same difference, yeah. And
except that she's from India and there was a Portuguese colony there in Goa.
Mm.
But good call in this hemisphere.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the daughter of the priest whose whole
Nolly.
Yes,
yeah.
Whose whole worth is in repeating bits of sermons and inventing.
She's got all the answers. She's got the catechism, but she doesn't understand the meat behind the ideas. In the same way that, you know, our leaders, so-called here, flaunt the word democracy, flaunt the word freedom, as a buzzword, as a catch-all. And if anything, I would hope that the language of John Dollar forces the reader to examine what the words mean. What does God mean?
Well, it creates a great linguistic comedy of language that's inadequate to its task
to its
of survival. Yeah.
Well, the reason that everybody ends up on this island is that the parents and the children have gone to rename an island which already has a name. They're renaming it. They're giving it an English name because it was named by an Italian explorer. And so they're going to go out and rechristen it, so to speak, with a new name. And then an earthquake happens and a tidal wave comes.
And turtles crawl
and
up
turtles,
on the shore.
Turtles crawl up on the shore during their feast on this island, the celebration, and they end up killing all the turtles.
As someone who has spent a period of time living on an enforced island, Lost. Did you find that the experience...
Is this Great Britain or Martha's Vineyard? Because I've moved from one small island to a greater one.
I was thinking of the metaphorical isolation. Was the experience of writing this desperate novel of non-survival in the face of seclusion helpful in dealing with the experiences that surrounded Salman Rushdie and by necessity involved you as well?
I think that's really looking for causality and sort of the fact that, you know, making a linear story out of a lifetime, my life that I'm living. So I'm not I don't have the perspective to say, oh yes, that really helped. I think it was just the fact that he's an extraordinary human being, I am an extraordinary human being, and the fact that we're used to solitude and writing, and that both of us were writers together. Yeah, lucky thing I wrote this book. It's more or less a silly kind of exercise to make. If I had written a book of limericks instead of writing John Dollar, who's to say that I wouldn't have acted different? I just can't answer that.
Lucky, too, that it was published when it was, because certainly if it were published now, it would be read very differently.
It was published when it was because it was written when it was. And I think that's also, you know, revisionist thinking. The book was written when it was written. It was written at the same time that Satanic Verses was written. And events that happened to me because of my stand of solidarity with my husband should not affect the way that people look at this book, John Dollar. John Dollar was written, you know, 3 years ago, before all this happened. It was ready to be published the week it was. There were books in the store the week that this happened. And again, I must say, and this pertains not only to myself, but to Salman, that I read Satanic Verses in manuscript. I was its first reader. No one will ever approach that work of art in the same way, and that's the great tragedy. People now are wearing this burden of history. Let's see what this thing that has happened in history, what was it all about? Where is it in these pages? Well, and unfortunately for him as a writer, he will always have that cloud over him. I don't.
Actually, it's interesting because both your book and his were booked for Bookworm, and so I'd read both of them well in advance, and when Salman was not able to make the trip here any longer. John Barth came in to speak about his situation. We invited him on. What interested me is that while Satanic Verses seems to me to be primarily a literary book, I mean, it's brilliant, it's difficult. As has been commented, most of the people who are taking offense to it couldn't possibly understand it. John Dollar seems to me to be the much more directly provocative book, and perhaps an assault on a Christian God.
I think the assault is on received ideas, and to try to, you know, lump together his book and my book is unfair to both of our books because it trivializes it. So, I mean, we need to talk about John Dollar away from these events because the events, if anything, have overshadowed what I hope is the pure and original voice of this novel. And my novel, John Dollar, has never been associated with any sort of attack on the Christian church. It's, you know, it's a rip-roaring adventure story about evil, love, sex, death, all the things that great literature, I hope, addresses.
You, by the time this airs, I'm in hope that a new book by Marion Wiggins will be on its way out. What is that book?
It's Learning Urdu, a collection of short stories, which Harper and Row are going to publish next January. That's January 91. A collection that was partially completed last February. The book was sold at the same time that John Dollar was sold. I've asked for an extension because I've written some new stories in this last year, and the manuscript is now finished. It's to say what is a collection of short stories about is pretty tough. I mean, you've got Herself in Love in front of you. Mm-hmm. What is that about?
Oh, I didn't ask what it was about. Yeah. I just asked what it was.
All right. Well, it is a collection of 11 stories.
Many of which have begun to appear in American magazines of late. I think I saw one in The New Yorker. Am I wrong?
You're wrong.
I am.
It's two in Harper's, one in Paris Review. I think that's it for the USA. If The New Yorker have published, I'm really shocked.
I was searching through my pile, actually, knowing that
it's
I'd
Harper's.
Seen it in a magazine that
Harper's.
Shape. And you are now working on a series of novels, I take it?
Yeah. The next one is about the year and the whole controversy and the ideas floating around in 1789 that were behind the actual writing of the Bill of Rights. Thomas Jefferson encouraging Madison to have a Bill of Rights attached to the Constitution. I don't know what form it's going to take. I've got about four or five more months of reading in constitutional law and historical facts before I start to put any word on paper, but I've got the feel of the book around me.
I wanted to ask you about the sense of history in John Dollar and that you're working on, I guess, a historical series in a sense. Is the narrative, by being placed in the past, it fascinated me that the distance of the past is broken by the intensity and the immediacy of the language. How will that be affected in
I worked very hard not to commit the sin of anachronism in the language of John Dollar, and I really don't think I did. I think that I held pretty close to being 1917. Now, in going back to 1789, hey, that's pretty vibrant language. Go read the Bill of Rights. So I have to cut out, you know, certain modern words. I can't include disco and, you know, a lot of the bush speak that's rattling around. That's not hard. It's poetic. It's wonderful. It's beautiful language.
The marvelous thing, in fact, about the language in John Dollar struck me as being that it doesn't seem pastiche at all. You know, there are many books, take The Sotweed Factor, for instance, in which you look at the language and you say, antique, mannered, very well done, extraordinarily difficult to do, but it's not trying to, what would you say, burst the seams of prose into poetry, whereas the language of John Dollar has, you know, a kind of Blakean immediacy and frenzy about it.
I hope. I hope I find that different but same but like kind voice for whatever work it is that I'm doing. And I would trust that my short stories evidence this, that same lack of studied pastiche. It's not a form that's natural to me.
Your different environments make you, more than many writers, a citizen of the world, more than of any particular country. Can you describe the environs of the prose you create?
I think that they come from, you know, the fact that I have the highest and most glorious respect and great love affair with the English language in all its forms, whether it be in England, where I happen to live now, or in Pennsylvania, where I grew up, where there was a great concentration and influence by the Pennsylvania Dutch. Throw Johnny down the stair, his hat, you know, that sort of thing. I had a Greek parent who was brought up in Virginia, so my uncle spoke both Greek and then a deeply, deeply slanged Tidewater Virginia accent. And I have heard how our American language is so elastic in the way that it absorbs Spanish phrases, all of our ethnic minorities, so that my sense of the language that I bring to my works comes from this wonderful enthusiasm for this language, English language, American English language. And let's face it, English language was pretty exciting too, because it was influenced not only by the French coming over with William the Conqueror, but the injection of enthusiasm that it's received from the Irish. Thank goodness for English, if it weren't for Yeats and Shaw, and the Welsh and the Scottish, and this wonderful expanding vocabulary that we have, as opposed to a rigid, very rigid language, which does not grow as Urdu is, which just has a set form of vocabularies, and then it plunks in English words. There are no law texts, for example, written in Urdu. There are no new books being published in Urdu. So that's my sense of who I am in terms of the of a person who no longer lives in the United States but writing in English, as a world voice. You bet, we've got a worldwide language, and it's so exciting to work in.
I've been speaking with Marion Wiggins, author of John Dollar, recently republished in paperback. Thank you for being with us, Marianne.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today has been Eric Myers. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books. Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse. Pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.